This is a podcast from wingsatliberty.com. Check out the wingsatliberty.com website where you will find more information about issues related to flying birds, learning to train birds, and events offering experiences with flighted birds. This podcast is a free service supported by the folks at organicbirdfood.com, makers of Foundation Formula Pellets, Dynamo Sprout Mixes, and Mary Medley Seed Mixes. That's www.organicbirdfood.com. Please show your support by visiting organicbirdfood.com.
This is Alternate Perspective, a Wings at Liberty podcast where we discuss issues related to free-flying birds. I'm Chris Biro, and today I'm joined by biologist and falconer Steve Lehman. All right, we're sitting here with the microphone on, and it's Chris Biro sitting with
Steve Lehman.
And today we're going to start out our discussion. I'm curious about how falconry, how people get into falconry, get started in falconry, get into flighted birds in the parrot community. People get into parrots for lots of reasons. Very few people get a parrot for the purpose of actually flying it. But in falconry, that is that's obviously the primary goal of somebody getting into falconry. So I would imagine that there's a number of procedures, a number of protocols, a number of philosophies, and probably different philosophies for getting people started in flying birds and falconry. So I'm kind of hoping that we can expand on that a little bit and find out if there's some common ground there today.
Falconry as a culture, as a culture, looking at it that way, there's already the predetermined fact that when somebody gets into falconry, that they're going to be flying the birds.
All right, well, there's a difference already. That's not a similarity, right? Because when people get into parrots,
But I see the only people that I know that have parrots is you,
right.
And that I have real close associations with. And I know your strong desire to explore those ideas, and in this situation, I'm humbled by the fact that somebody of your background and experience of flying your parrots would, ask me questions about how to do that. And I don't know anything about parrots, so what I'm going to do is talk about falconry and how within the culture of falconry that transition is made. And there's lots of variations. But the only thing I can relate to is how I go about it.
Right.
When somebody comes to me and wants to become a falconer, I really don't go out of my way to encourage people to do it, because it is such a lifestyle changing, activity to do. But it's still, juggle family, business, jobs, and those things. A lot of very successful falconers are able to manage all those things. And that is probably the biggest thing that needs to be taken into account.
And this is something that people are struggling with in the parrot community at this point. People are discovering that they have an interest in flying birds, but they haven't yet realized exactly what's involved, what kind of commitment is involved. And so it has this appeal to it, and there are people that think they want to do it, but it hasn't yet really sunk in that keeping parrots in this manner is a little bit like keeping horses. You either have the right setup and have the right lifestyle in order to be able to keep them. You don't just keep them in a
location.
You have to be able to take them out and pasture them, and this type of keeping parrots is quite a bit different than what most people with parrots are doing. And people haven't quite got that yet, I don't think.
Yeah. So, and the parallels, again, are exactly the exact same thing. So generally what I do, if somebody's showing an interest, one, I have to look at my own time. I'm able to, donate the time, because somebody can't pay me to do it. That's not, something that I do. I have to find the people being, interest, polite, courteous of my time, and show, some interest in reading some books and giving a call. And if I have the time, talk to them. And one of the first things I do is I If they haven't read a lot about falconry, there's a in the falconry circles, there's a website called The Modern Apprentice. And it's done by some, put together by somebody, Lydia Ash, that as a novice, she was out looking for information, and she was in the computer industry, and she just started accumulating the information. So I asked them to go to that, to books. If somebody's at a distance, I prefer to have somebody close to me so we can form some sort of an association. And the first thing I asked them to do is go and find some people that are flying some of the hawks. Come out with me at their picnics, gatherings, and you do the sort of thing where you're going out to Moab where birds
are
being
flown. We're trying
to
get this started. Because right now falconry has a long history. Right. And therefore has numbers on your side. You got a lot of people that are, lot more people that are involved in falconry. We in the bird community, in the parrot community, right, have almost nobody. There's just a very limited number of people available.
But I would
and
imagine,
resources as well.
I would imagine everybody that's here listening to this that have parrots have thought about it, wondering who it would be like.
You have people asking on the free flight list all the time, is there somebody near
right.
me?
Yeah, and here's what I recommend to somebody that I sponsor is meet some other people that are doing it. If they're not around, give me a call. If they're not willing to travel to be around me or somebody else that's flying their birds and see how their lifestyles are changed and what the kinds of accommodations that they're making. Then the next thing I do, now, if I've decided that I'm going to help this person, and I like them as a person, main thing, and then I ask them to do some specific reading. I ask them to get a hold of Karen Pryor's book, Don't Shoot the Dog, get her clicker training.
Great book.
Great book. It's simple, but the reading between the lines, there's lots of material there. I've got all kinds of other books, but she's done a great job. And I know Karen. She's even had me at one of her seminars to bring some falcons and show how I shape hooding behavior and recall and things like that. And so I asked them to read that book and then come out with me. And in the course of reading the book, I basically asked them, do you have a dog or a cat? Do you have a bird? Take that book and start applying the concepts. How to establish a conditioned reinforcer, shape some simple behaviors, put them on cue, create a chain. And understanding timing is critical. And demonstrate to me that they really do understand the concepts involved. And anybody coming into this sport, I assume they don't have a lot of natural history understanding. It would be great if they did, but they won't generally. But I do want them to understand how to shape and modify behavior.
Let's expand just a little bit on the natural history.
Okay.
Define a little bit so people understand exactly what you mean when you say natural history.
Okay, and then with predators in particular, with the exception of harris hawks and some of the eagles, they're not social like parrots are, or like dogs or horses. And there are social behaviors that you can rely upon to occur and be able to incorporate it into your training. The fight or flight is really big. Negative reinforcement, in the big picture, doesn't work with raptors. The falconry culture over the centuries.
Negative reinforcement or positive punishment.
I think that's a detailed discussion. People in our training of our dogs and cats, we use a lot of habituation. Grab the leash, jerk on it, push down on the rear, and that works. Some of that can work in falconry. Birds can be just tied to the fist, and they can be habituated to the environment that they're in, and they're very intelligent, and they'll figure out what is a threat to them and what isn't. And when they become hungry, they're looking for sources of food, and you offer them food, and they'll begin to eat it. And recognizing the behaviors of when they're hungry, and those kinds of things are kind of intuitive directions. But once I understood operant conditioning as a tool, like a hammer, you can take a hammer, it's a great tool, you can break glass with it, you can pound holes in the wall, but when you learn to hit a nail on the head and drive it, and use, you know, gravity and inertia and all those things.
Use the right amount of force.
Force, yeah, that sort of thing. Operant conditioning in terms of positive reinforcement to shape behavior, to develop interactions, is a real powerful thing in the training of raptors. And a lot of people in their everyday life may use it intuitively, know that you're nice to people and you'll get some reaction if you're nasty to them, or if you're a boss or an employer, for example, and you see them as captive individuals and you're ordering them around and you get results. That's one way to do it. But another way is to, you know, take that new employee, so to speak, and shape their behavior into doing the task done. And operant conditioning, the concepts, you know, there's more than just positive reward. There's, you know, the removal of a negative and pairing that with the conditioned reinforcer. And for those of you who are listening to this, that these words may be foreign to your concept, Karen's book will introduce you to all of those. And then her real simple book on clicker training your dog or your cat. And she's got a great website, you know, to do that. So I'll ask the person I'm sponsoring to do that in their lab. I'll even ask them if with their friends, you know, that they have, and I'll even play shaping games with them so they can experience what it's like to have behavior shaped without the use of language or without the use of body language. Because when the hawk comes into that new environment, they don't come pre-wired, you know, like maybe a dog would be to read human body language. Or the great social mix that, you know, some of the parrots will have, if exposed to people long enough, they kind of gravitate to that. Certain element of that in raptors, but and, you know, not a lot, and the novice wouldn't be able to recognize those behaviors anyway.
Right.
So a firm understanding, a practical application of the concepts. And then by observing me and coming out, generally... when I sponsor somebody, they're in the field with me for a year, 6 months, one good hunting season anyway. And they see me pick the birds up and the way they're housed. And a lot of time when they're not even being flown, I take them out and fly them. And we talk about that transition. I introduce them to other people because I don't have the way of doing things. And every new bird that I handle, I don't handle necessarily in the same way.
Right, I'm the same way. Each bird is going to be slightly different.
And you and I bring to what we do years of experience. And so I empathize with somebody coming into the sport of falconry being sponsored by me because, I have a hard time saying this, and this, what to do. But I have an obligation to try to break it down to as simply as possible. And so, and my first obligation is to the bird they're going to train. I don't want them to be, you know, stressed and in bad health as a result of it. I don't want physical damage because of improper handling techniques, injury would occur, or the training of the bird, then go out for their first free flight and lose them. And because of that period of time, in that domestic environment, they may have lost some conditioning and now they're out in the wild and may not be able to survive. My obligation is to make sure that person is prepared to take the best care of that bird.
And have the best results.
And best results. And for me, that is falconry has a long history and it's outlined in the book. I want them to be exposed to those same things, but I want them to have the operant conditioning tools so that they can more quickly be able to get the desired behaviors that they want. How to take and when they get the bird, it's going to be frightened, or if it's a juvenile being raised by hand, it's going to be imprinted. How do they make that transition? And in the course of doing that, their behaviors are going to be shaped, and a common language operant conditioning, especially with the use of a condition reinforcer and establishing cues, it would be like two people that speak totally different language. And having a very simple way, you know, from two different planets, two ecologically different niches, and finding a common language. The other thing I want to teach them is and expose them to the reality is we think in my case in the past I'm imposing my will on them, teaching them what I want them to do for me, and where in reality I get the best results when I'm very much in tune with what they're doing, and then as the process moves along, they literally feel that they're in control of me. They do things to make me do things. And then as a result of that, there's this common language. So somebody I'm sponsoring, I want them to be in the community, in the culture, see the lifestyle of the people are doing it. In your case, there are not a lot of free-flying people that are free-flying, a lot of people making it an attempt. They can go to your website and see it, you know, happening. Other people around the country are in the stages of doing that. And so the first thing, after those things are acquired, I trust the person. We get the bird in their hand. And then within the safe environments of their home or in their facility, that training process starts. You know, one, getting to eat, establish a condition reinforcer, get them to recall is going to be really, really important. Be able to put them on the back of a chair, hold food out, have them come. You know, it seemed rather straightforward, but I want them to apply operant conditioning techniques in the process of doing that. And then the other thing, and with the parrots, I'm sure in time, you already recognize this, before going out into that literally wild environment, it's a good idea to have the birds in really, really good shape. They know how to fly, land, especially with their young hawks that are being raised. If they're taken out and turned loose too soon before they're mature enough to handle it, wind can blow them away. They can get up in the trees and it's a new environment and they're just emotionally looking around, so much information coming in, they just literally mentally don't know how to get down. So they need to be brought into that environment.
This is a point that has come up a few times. People often think that the bird gets up in the air, gets up in a tree, and then doesn't know how to come down.
Yeah.
I've always said that people's birds do know how to come down. The question is they've got fears, conflicting interests.
Yes.
Gravity
will
help them come down.
Yeah.
The question of coming down isn't a question of not knowing how. Yeah. It's a question of not being willing to.
And the relationship between the person especially with the hawks that already know how to fly, if the relationship is a stressful one and they have a choice to come down to that person who they don't like or don't trust, and they can go away from them, and they know when they have that kind of freedom.
Right. Well, hopefully with pet parrots, we don't have that many people out there that are trying to fly a bird that is stressed by their presence.
Yeah, the novice may not recognize that. And in falcon, we see this a lot. I'm around a novice falconer with their very first birds and attempts, and they're flying them and they're getting them back, and I can see in the behavior that there's a bit of stress going on between the two of them, and it'll solve itself over time, but it needs to be kind of pointed out. And one of the best ways to see that lack of trust is in the process of shaping behavior.
Sure.
And that the birds, the hawks, will not willingly do it unless they know something to their advantage to do it.
Well, that's part of the advantage of training a few tricks. I always tell people to train a few simple parlor tricks, because in that process, you and the bird learn how to communicate with each other, and you learn, the bird will learn to trust that there's a system in place, and that you can be honored to do what you're part of the process and give him things that he wants if he does things you want.
Yeah. My goal is to, with a novice falconer and myself, is get into the field as fast as I can and fly them and hunt with them, and to do that in such a way that they're safe when they're turned loose for the first time and can be retrieved and get them back. And in the course of doing that with somebody that doesn't have the insights and the time and the experience in falconry, they have to get those experiences. One is observing and the other is doing before they go out. And I like to have somebody that I sponsor, like you say, train tricks. Falconers aren't inclined to do that, but our recall is a big thing.
Flying a trick.
Yep. And flying to the fist or flying to the lure, and the lure is just an object that food can be tied to, and doing that in a safe environment, first inside, then going outside on a creance. I understand in the parrot culture, there are some that have vests that you can't
harnesses.
Put harnesses, and to be able to do that. And another would be in conversations we've had, and I'm looking at your facilities, big flight cages. Taking the time and effort to put a flight cage together to go outside in a new environment and train the behavior. Because one of the things that within operant conditioning, anybody that's shaped behavior knows that in one environment that you train a behavior, it may not transfer to another.
Right, they have to generalize it.
Yep, and then being able to do that safely and then at their own pace and comfort, make that transition the day that they're flying loose.
Now, I want to touch on the harness concept, the leash concept mm-hmm. briefly. In falconry, you use a leash, a creance, for training purposes.
Right.
But as a rule, they're not using that creance for just for recreational purposes.
No. It's just a transitional safety. And not knowing whether recall is there, or the birds.
I've been somewhat resistant to
understand
a leash because of my fear of knowing people and myself as well. You know, being a person, it's really, really easy to let a bird get up in the air with that leash dangling. We make mistakes all the time. If that happens, that bird can be there.
Yeah. Well, it's tied to me. And most of the time, the flight distance when they're flying is no more than maybe 30 yards. And put them on a fence post or off somebody else's hand, fly to make sure that I have a cue and I have the behavior, well established. When I give the cue, they come to me and do it in a number of different environments. And then be able to make the transition after recall, then back into home and to that domestic life and going back out and doing it again. And when I'm certain that those parameters are established, quickly as possible, they're no longer tethered and taking them to new environments, flying them, and then that more and more flight time will occur, especially with the falcons that are trained to be on the wing, flying overhead for long periods of time. And how to develop that behavior and that relationship with them when they're on wing. Windy days, knowing what kinds of things might frighten them. Are they afraid of cows and strange dogs? And all of these things have to be discovered in those things in the environment that just unexpectedly might show up. And to determine what they and where those issues are before the day they're even turned loose.
Sure.
Picking an environment, and you have talked about this at great length. How would you assess, if we had to break this down, we do it kind of intuitively. Now I look and say, this is not where I'm going to fly this hawk for the first time. I'm going to go over here, less distraction. Or another bird, cars, strange dogs, things like that, that can be several hundred yards away and not be a problem. And then do it. But for the novice, the things that on an everyday basis, be able to do it without creating stress, clear communications, being able to shape behavior with operant condition and concepts. I want them to learn the vocabulary, the concepts, and then be able to demonstrate them and then apply them.
I want to ask you, I want to step in here and ask you about your opinion of the time that you've spent helping new people. Uh-huh. how beneficial do you find that for yourself? I find it immensely. It just teaches me so much because I have to look at what I do.
It causes me to analyze. If anything goes wrong, it's my fault. If there's something that's not understood, I should have realized that I had to do a better job of explaining. It's a real great responsibility, and I know you've expressed that.
Oh yeah.
You know, that you throw a concept out and you see you free flying your birds, and it'd be horrifying to think that somebody would look at that and then go out and just do that, and they're going to lose them, or go into an environment with a bird. We experience this with Cooper's hawks and kestrels, or my male goshawks, to go out and fly them in an area. We've got golden eagles around, and my goshawk is not in very good condition. Should an eagle go after it, can it? A goshawk is way more maneuverable, and in an environment that I'm flying all the time, in a forest situation, they have a way to get away. And if I'm out in the sagebrush flying, my goshawk's even more vulnerable. And the time of day when the eagles are most active. And knowing about that, we fly early in the morning before the wind starts to blow in the areas that we hunt out in the desert. In one area, lots of eagles, and we fly in the morning, and midday we stop. The demons of the sky are out there. We call them the feather mafia, and they can extract a heavy toll. But if the hawks have been brought along and exposed to those environments, we can go into those environments and fly and hunt without occurring.
I'm curious. Do raptors like this actually have is there any kind of a special interest in attacking and killing another raptor in the area? In other words, would a golden eagle be more prone to go for a goshawk because of maybe competitive issues or
not more prone to do it? There are times when the prey for an eagle. It's kind of far and few between. And another predator out there hunting is going to catch a quarry, very likely the eagle can't catch. And when they see that happen, they'll come in low altitude, sneak in, and if my goshawk sees them coming, they'll leave, and then the eagle will take their prey.
Okay.
And remind me to pick up here, but an interesting side note. One of the theories in falconry, how falconry got started, was that very thing. Some of our ancestors out hunting on the steppes of Central Asia on horseback see a falcon or an eagle fly and catch a hare. You run up and scare them off and you take the food from them.
And then if you nurture that relationship at some point.
And I've had this happen. Falconers, other people have seen this, even the farmer on the tractor. When you're moving through the landscape, you'll scare up what is the hawk or the goshawk or the eagle's food, and then when it gets at a safe distance, and they'll fly down and catch it. So
creating a symbiotic relationship.
That's right. And it hawks follow coyotes and watch them hunt, and when they're out at a distance and they can fly down and catch the rabbit that has been scared, and that rabbit's moving back to its territory and caught, and then the coyote maybe catches something else and doesn't see it. So, and I have friends of mine that, some really good friends that, and I've had this happen to me, is we recognize the presence of a hunting raptor, wild one, and then go out and flush quarry for them. And they'll show up and catch them. And a few days of doing this, a good friend of mine, Ron, he was out with his pointer, and small birds and merlins would come in and hunt. The next day it shows up, and he would show up at the same time and go out and let his bird flush, and this wild merlin, and he also had a wild male peregrine come in over his dog and wait on. In a classic falconry, Ron was just a total observer, and it would catch it. Not only would it catch it, but it would go off and cache it and then come back and then fly again and then catch the small birds that were out there. One time a wild duck was flushed and the peregrine came in and caught the duck, and he didn't want to be on the ground with the dog there, so he called the dog off, and the peregrine had its food. And so it goes on a lot. So the relationship in a falconry situation is a very natural one, to fly and have this symbiote. And that's what I see with your parrots, the flock behavior, the close relationship that's there. And it's a very natural thing to happen. And but to make that preparation transition to gain enough, for the novice to gain enough knowledge and practical experience to do that without endangering or threatening the life and health of the bird they're working with, and I've my little son Conyer that I flew loose, I because of my background, I realized that chances are because of my lifestyle, Jamina was going to get out.
It's not just your lifestyle. Most people that have flighted birds really have to be concerned about it because at some point, get out.
Yep. And so I did recall in the house, and I realized that Jamina, like Kathy, hated me, and he had a strong association with his cage to be fed, and played some games with him, shaping his behavior to go in his cage. And if that time ever happened, I felt really certain that I could recall him with the cage. And in our house, we just gave him full run. His wings weren't clipped. In the other home, his wings had been clipped. And quickly, got him through that molt so he could fly really well, shaped behaviors with him, played games, and then played games with his cage. And so day came. Sure enough, he got out a window. And he was out there flying around, tried to recall. To me, it wasn't going to work. Great, didn't panic. I've had this happen with my hawks, and I had a Sun Conyers, those beautiful colors. It seemed like, man, you'd be a target in the wild. But when he was sitting in alders and dappled light, he disappeared.
Right.
I couldn't believe it.
I've seen scarlets flying to trees, and you go, where the heck did they go?
Okay, I was just, and so one of the things that I noticed with him and was doing in the house, Jama, call back, reward the behavior. Jama, call back, reward the behavior. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, if he's up in the tree, he's frightened. If I call his name, would he call back? And sure enough, I'd call him. So I knew where he was. Even though I couldn't see him, I knew where he was. And I walked out, and over the course of a couple hours, pretty soon, he worked his way down through the trees and down in closer, and because I understood my relationship with him. He didn't like me like Kathy. Kathy wasn't around, and he flew down and got in his cage. And while I walked up and closed the door, he threatened me from inside the cage. It was almost like, why did you do this sooner, sort of a thing. And back in the house, and then over the course of the next week or so, I established that recall, turned him loose on the back porch, and then to the point where he was loose. Lots. Call his name in the house, through the door, back in.
That's kind of how I got started with free flying parrots. I was building a 16 by 24 foot outdoor cage for the birds, and I had it done, I thought, and I had this umbrella cockatoo that kept getting out of the cage. What it turned out she was doing is she was pushing the wire away from the frame. It was a chain link fence construction, and so you tie the wire to the frame, and I had a spot that didn't have enough ties, and it was loose enough at that point that she could push her way through there. Well, of course, I'm looking for holes, and it took me a good week to figure out where she's getting out of this cage, because I'd inspect the cage and I'm not finding any hole. But what would happen during that time is she would go up in the air and spend her day hanging out in the trees above the house, and in the evening start screaming her little head off, and that was her signal that, hey, I want to come in. And so I'd go out there, and sure enough, she'd work her way down. Sometimes she'd fly right over me and miss me and go up to another tree, and after 10 or 15 minutes of this, she'd come down and land on my hand. And it only took a couple of days of this to realize, I'm getting her back pretty easy. And as soon as I found the hole by that point, which is like a week later, by that point I was totally convinced. And so I just started turning her loose on purpose.
Yeah.
And that's how I got started doing this, is the same kind of thing. And I've heard other stories of people who kind of accidentally discover, hey, you know, we can do this, and it works. And at that point, I began looking for ways to figure out how to do it right. I started trying to train my other macaws, and only to discover, as I was working with the macaws, trying to teach them recall, they were slow. And then I wound up getting a baby greenwing at the time. And that greenwing picked it up so incredibly fast, just right now. And that's what it dawned on me. Well, the way to do this is with a young bird at the same age that would learn in the wild. But I trained the greenwing the same way I was trying to train the others. Actually used a leash and a tether kind of a setup. And I took a long time to do it, like I would an adult. And so I had this theory in the back of my head that if I did this right with a baby, I should be able to do it very quickly. And so I was at some breeders for a sexing clinic. Scott McDonald's a veterinarian that travels around and sexes birds. And so I was at the Scudder's property there for Scott McDonald to show up. And I was talking to Martha Scudder after the sexing had happened, and I said, well, you know, I need to get me a baby for flying birds. And I was just talking about the theory a little bit, and she responds, well, you need a Patagonian. And so I was just, you know, just kind of talking. She said, I'm going to give you a Patagonian. Well, I didn't think anything about it. And a few weeks later, she calls me and says, when are you going to come pick up your baby Patagonian? Okay. So I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. So I go and I get the little bird, and his name is Obi. He's with me. He's out there in the cage right now. And he still flies with us. And sure enough, after a couple of weeks, you know, I'm hand feeding this little bird, and he's finishing getting all of his feathers. And after a couple of weeks of this, I had him flying in the house as he started to, you know, develop those natural interests in flying, and got him flying in the house and started flying back and forth to a perch in the house. And we turned this into a game, and he's mastered it really well. It was just this fun thing we did. And at some point, you could see him starting to do maneuvers in the air on the way to the cage across the living room. And at that point, I kind of realized that he's now trying to expand his skill level inside this environment. He's mastered what he can learn in here, and we're ready to go outside. And I think 2 weeks later, I had him flying at a county fair with me just a little bit. And next thing you know, he's part of the show flying at the fairs. And so he was 2 weeks. Let's see, he was, I had him flying at fairs for a little over two months old till about 4 months old. That season he flew with me. And it was just it was totally different to training the adults. Mm-hmm. I mean, the adult work was really slow, but that little baby bird just, he did it himself. I didn't have to teach him hardly anything. Yeah. He just picked it up. All I had to do was control the environment. And I built my whole training program now around their natural responses, the way they would learn in the wild. And it's become very quick, very efficient. And for the most part, they're training themselves. My job is to simply control the environment, give them the experiences that they need. For instance, we're going to teach them recall in the house. We're going to also give them time sitting in a cage outside so that they're getting comfortable being in the outdoor environment. Because no matter how good their recall is indoors, if you turn them loose outside and they're all panicked by that, then you're not going to have predictable behavior. So if they're calm, our goal is to have them calm. So we want to give them some time getting used to being outdoors. And by the time I do take them out there, I do have some history with the bird because I've seen him. You've seen his responses indoors. I know what his responses are outdoors in a cage. So I've got a good idea that at that point he's going to be successful. But you still don't really know what's really going to happen. So that first time's a little bit.
Falconry has a similar, you know, long history. And the last conversation we had, we talked about hack and taking advantage of that natural, the instincts and the sequences in their development. and replicating what occurs in the wild. And that they have, as they grow up, their powers of flight don't come full formed, and they have a, and even when they fly very well, they have a strong instinct to stay in the vicinity of their nest and around their parents. And the raising of young hawks, just exactly the way you described, is we call it imprinting, and getting the birds that are 14, 15 days old, form those strong associations, and then they naturally start to fly, you know, in the house, and we call it a muse, an aviary, and then outside. And once that experience has been had a few times, I now know that when they reach that point where they're branching and jumping around through the limbs, I go out on my deck and I have an old cherry tree there and an old pine tree close to the house, and they jump up into that. And then each day their powers of flight get better, and I bring them in at night to get them away from the owls.
Sure.
And day by day that progresses.
So you're letting them actually learn their first flights outside?
You know, in the house, on the porch, because they can't fly very far.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, actually, parrots, I can say that the first flights I've had go outside are
some of the whole nesting,
pretty...
Some of the whole nesting birds, for example, like starlings, they develop really quickly, and when they come out of their nests, they're ready to go. Young falcons, staying, you can imagine they're on a cliff face, several hundred feet.
Right.
That first flight had better be a good one.
That's right. And this is true for parrots, because most parrots... Yeah. Not all, of course, but many parrots live in tall trees,
yes,
in cavities in tall trees.
Yep.
Some live in sandstone cliff faces. So that first flight is, not usually hopping to a...
No. If you're down on the forest floor, you're going to be picked up by ground predators.
Right.
And but they still have a real strong tendency to get back to the nest. Also, the food begging behavior, the parents will go to them. And so I it's called Hack. Right now I'm flying and very interested in the genus Accipiter, the goshawks, coopers, and sharp shins, and their behavior is a little bit different than falcons.
I'm interested in them too, just from a slightly different reason.
Oh yeah, yeah. And when you're flying when I'm flying my goshawks, then I'm out there hunting, and there have been several times my goshawks have taken out after Cooper's hawks. Cooper's hawks would be down in the blackberries chasing quail and small birds around, and I'm out hunting rabbits, and all of a sudden a Cooper's hawk flushes out of the brush, and my goshawk is after it. Cooper's hawks, good in their wild ones, in good shape, very maneuverable, and my goshawk can't close on them. So I see both sides. My goshawk could catch something and long distance away from it, and a wild red tail that's bigger could come in and kill him. And that gets back to the safety thing. And with our babies, they make that natural progression. We're playing the part of parent to protect them from those other predators. An aviary would be great, depending on where I live. I live in a wooded environment. It's open around my house. I have dogs around, people coming and going. The wild predators are less likely to come in and to do harm. And I've never lost any of my birds in that situation. And then when they're flying, just like you described, I'm training recall, and I know I wait. I like to. I'm not managing their weight to make them hungry, but I'm training them on their appetite.
Right. Well, that's the way we do.
Feathers are growing, muscles are growing, and they're hungry kids, and now they want to be fed.
And with a baby parrot that's growing up, it's incredibly easy because they do have a very strong bond to the person
and
that's
the
feeding them.
Raptors the same way.
And there's no reason to be using hunger management on a baby bird like that. A favorite treat is fine. In fact, initially, for those first indoor flights, what I call them desperation flights for parrots, because what they'll do is they will want to get to the back of a chair or a cage top someplace really, really bad, and they will just make this, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I gotta jump, and there they go, and they get to that cage, and you'll see a few of those flights for a day or so, maybe 2 days, and then at some point you'll see them that they're not flying so desperate to get to a particular location, but now they're starting to realize, hey, I can have some fun with this flying, and they start exploring, so I call those exploration flights.
Yes, yep.
And you see the flights indoors, we get those flights expanded, and it doesn't take very long that they're going to start coming to meat. And a lot of times it has nothing to do with food at all, because they're
right.
still being hand-fed. They don't eat anything else, mm-hmm. but they just want to come to me because we've already got a relationship
yeah.
developing. And that strong relationship is to my advantage and to theirs, because it gives us a reason to play this fly back and forth game.
Right along that line, even though the hawks are not noted for their social behavior, when baby hawks are growing up in a nest, they're shoulder to shoulder playing all of their little hierarchical games, but they share warmth. They come back to the nest when they branch. When the parent comes in with food, many times they go right back to the nest. So I have the nest in the kitchen, and when it comes time, I wait for them to go to the nest, and I go there and feed them. So my first recalls, I let them exhibit the behavior, classic operant. I'm not going to force the behavior,
right.
wait for the behavior to occur, and reward them.
Start capturing.
Any movement that comes toward me, I'm going to reward it. And then I'll put it on cue later. And for those of you who are listening to this that don't have a working knowledge of operant conditioning, one of the things to investigate is the difference between a cue and a conditioned reinforcer. And that whistle to come, and the whistle you might use for a conditioned reinforcer, they're two separate things. One is to reward a new behavior, and then the other is to give the signal you want a behavior that you've trained to occur.
I like to just think of it as a cue is a signal that signals an opportunity is now available
yes.
for you to earn a
yep.
goodie.
Yep.
And the conditioned reinforcer, the bridging signal,
yes.
is the signal that says you've now done the behavior yep. and earned the goodie.
Yep.
So it's like a traffic light.
Yep.
And the traffic light comes on, it says you now have the opportunity to go through
yes.
the light in a safe manner.
That's right.
And, of course, there's no bridging signal.
Yep.
Nobody's clicking you for going through the light. But
at whatever level of understanding, the attempting to do this, and I'm now convinced with my raptors that those that I've raised as little babies, and as they're growing up, and I'm playing these shaping games, and this is a bit of a stretch, I think they end up smarter.
Oh, I have no... I have no question about that.
It has something to do with neural development, and I can you imagine raising children without language?
Right. Well, see, what I see is that all I have to do is look at the... You know, I think I see it in an observational with parrots. You know, I could say mm-hmm. that I think that I see smarter, more active birds that I've raised as compared to the birds that people have raised and given to me.
Mm-hmm.
But in thinking about it from an organism standpoint of what happens in their development, when I raise a baby bird, that little bird is being stimulated very quickly, getting lots of love and attention, which mm-hmm. all baby creatures need for the most part, mm-hmm. especially social ones like parrots.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can't almost give them enough love at that point. Anyway, they're getting lots of love and attention, so their emotional needs are met in that respect. And their brain is being stimulated.
Yeah.
They are not being held back. They are learning to think. They're learning to observe. They're learning to interact and socialize.
Fly.
Yeah. And the flying starts immediately,
yep.
so all their natural instinctive urges relating to flight are being kicked off right at the right time, as opposed to somebody who raises a bird, a breeder that's raising it, even if they're going to let it fly and sell it as a flighted bird, you've got this bird who now is spending a lot of time in an incubator alone or maybe with another chick, but not getting the kind of social mm-hmm. interaction that we're going to give it as the new mm-hmm. owner. And they're just simply they're going to be delayed in getting that level of interaction going,
mm-hmm.
and that mental stimulation, mm-hmm. getting those neurons firing in that
yeah.
brain, that as compared to what we do.
I've been in your home and watched the raising of all the conures, and you had several others, and as I explore what species I want to get, and I'm going right to free flying, I'm going into as babies. And from my experience in falconry, I want to get them at that point in which imprinting occurs. I want control of that. I'm going to be hanging out at your house and learning how to feed, so I don't have feeding problems, because I could see the food delivery and the way they move their tongue and their beak and the places and using syringes. You know, there's
well, absolutely,
special...
and that's a really important point, because in my mind, when I talk about if I'm evaluating methods to train flight, mm-hmm. I'm not evaluating that method based on any kind of political agenda or anything like that. I'm looking at the method purely on the standpoint of, is this method a good method for training flight? And mm-hmm. if I'm comparing them and I want to say which is the best, which is going to have the greatest chance of success, mm-hmm. I'm purely looking at it from the method itself and its effectiveness. Mm-hmm. There's other issues, of course, that have to play into this. I mean, if I were to say that by far the best method is to train a bird in a 10,000 foot facility where the bird can't get lost, that might actually be the best method. Mm-hmm. Now, it may be a problem, though, in coming up with 10,000 square foot mm-hmm. facilities to do this in. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, the method of itself is better than maybe some other method. Yeah. And in my case, I believe that training a baby bird as opposed to training an adult bird that you already have is by far the safest method for training, for having and getting into free-flying parrots. Yeah. This is not to say, though, that there are not other complicated factors mm-hmm. involved. And learning to hand-feed a baby bird is a very important part of this mm-hmm. if you're going to do that method. Mm-hmm. I'm by no means suggesting that just because I think that training with baby bird means that you ignore the hand feeding part and just let anybody do this. That's not at all what I would try to say.
Sorry, I opened a can of worms.
Well, it's a touchy issue because it's been an issue that there are some people out there.
I know in my falconry and this gets back to the natural history experience. I would like to see breeding parrots feed. And in your place, next time I get a chance, I'd like to see how they go about. What are the behavioral interactions and the cues from the juvenile to the adults and mouth position? And I know the breeders are doing that, but I also know from my own practical experience with my falconry birds, those developmental times for me are really important.
They're critical in my mind. Absolutely correct.
And then when back to this situation, I have a good friend of mine, Joel, that spent his time and passion training my son to play soccer, and he'd always dreamed about being a falconer, and I've kind of held him at arm's distance because I didn't have the time, and now his kids are grown, and my kids are out of soccer, and I have an obligation. He put a lot of time and interest in his passion to my youngest son. And soccer is a big deal, so I'm giving back to Joel now. And Joel's situation will be different than mine. And when I'm not going to have him, one, legally, can't get a young bird, but I wouldn't recommend that he go that direction. We're going to get a wild hawk and capture it and train it. And the Department of Wildlife and Fish and Wildlife knows that the birds in the wild, the young ones of the year, there's 70-80% mortality rate. So the birds that come into falconry have a better chance of surviving to adulthood because we fly them for a couple of years and then release them back into the wild. So I'm going to recommend that Joel take that route instead of raising a baby bird. When the time comes that Joel wants to raise a young hawk, he'll have a really good understanding of all the behavior. And he may not have the luxury I do to do a hack, raise the baby in the house, make the transition, duplicating the natural history. But there's another way of doing it for those that are listening that might be interested in going that route, to raise them in the house and then have a small aviary to be able to do it. And then on a daily basis, when I lived in a small town in eastern Washington, after work, I would pick my young falcon up and I would go out of the biggest, most wide-open area I could at the stage in its life that it couldn't fly far.
Right.
And it had a strong tendency to stay close to me. And I would go out and sit from 5 to 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night and just let it fly. It had no place to go. No big trees. I wouldn't turn them loose. I would do with several of my prairie falcons when the wind was blowing really hard. And they would learn to fly.
Right. What you're talking about at this point is selecting your environment
right.
for your skill level of your bird.
And you're really
we don't have the option as a rule of going out and capturing a wild parrot out of the wild. There are some actually in cities in the country, but that's still not...
This is the point I was getting to, the raising the baby to do that. When I had the blue crown conure, you know, Skippy and Wendy at my place, you have no idea what their previous history were, the rescue birds that you picked up.
Right.
And you're going to be traveling, and I had the opportunity and the privilege to have them in our home, Kathy and I. And in such with them, I would like to free fly them, and I didn't do it time wise and everything else. Need to, you know, return them, but secondhand birds, what a great challenge. In falconry, there are a number of occasions when I've had that happen. Rehab facilities will. The most recent one, a wild peregrine, had a broken wing, hit a telephone line, as near as we can figure. And the vets healed it up, and they're looking at it, and her flight skills and the injury was such they didn't know that just flying in an aviary, if they turned it loose, she'd go out and die. So the Fish and Wildlife gave her to me to evaluate and get her in condition. So that wild falcon, in the course of training, we do things where we vertically jump and play all kinds of exercise games. And in that environment, closed, safe environment, I could build muscle, stress the muscles and tendons, and to see if she could take on a wild life, so to speak. And then did the transition outside, you know, onto creance, and then stoop her to the lure.
Of course, this bird has got flight experience
right.
of its own in the
but
past.
But then I've had... birds that were given to me that came right out of captive breeding projects that have never flown wild, that have been in big, huge aviaries breeding.
But they've had the ability to fly in those aviaries. Yeah, that's a difference that you run into. You very rarely find a mature hawk or falcon in falconry that has not had flight experience.
Yeah.
We routinely have people in parrots.
Sometimes it can happen that a bird might be tethered for long periods of time.
Never having exposure to flight. See, we run into it all the time with people.
It's going to be
never have.
And I see in your big aviary some of the birds that you when they came to you, they had clipped wings. You have an idea of their approximate age, and out of the one big enclosure, they're walking around on the ground.
Will not fly. Will not refuse.
And in a big aviary like you have out there, it would be an interesting experiment to see what would you look at born free the lions
right.
you know and the tigers that have you know come out of zoos and take them into that environment and not that these parrots would ever be turned loose, but it would be fascinating to understand what the limitations
are.
Get
them flying.
Yeah.
My concern is as we're having this discussion, my concern is not so much can I get them flying. The question is, if we're going to talk about new people, which is kind of where we're started here with this, that's the most difficult project to approach. Wouldn't put a new person on that.
No, that's exactly the direction I was going. When I compare the birds that I've started out young and they have flying experience to that, there's always those limitations. But in terms of somebody that has a pet like that in their home and with the possibilities that ever escape, that just recall would be a great thing to have.
I've actually recovered many birds, helped people recover their birds that are lost. And the difference between trying to recover a bird that's had no flight skill development, no recall training, and the bird, that has had recall training, it's night and day.
Yeah.
I would say as far as chances of getting a bird back that have been lost and getting it back the first day are probably 90%. Maybe 95% if you've had some recall training with the bird, as opposed to maybe 20 to 30% with a bird who's had no training.
Yeah,
and the worst is one who's partially clipped. That bird is first off, he's got no interest in flying because he's got no training in flying. He's got to work like crazy because he's got no muscle tone. He doesn't even have the full complement of feathers, so he doesn't even have the ability to fly very well. And if he's sitting at the top of a tree someplace, good luck.
Yep.
He's not coming down.
So it's a matter of what are the odds of those things happening, and experimenting with those birds that have that kind of history.
Which I've done some. You know, I've trained some of my adult birds, and sometimes people want to say that, you know, we only train babies because it's easy and we don't train our adults, but the fact is, I have many trained birds that fly in the aviary, and, and I've flown birds outside as part of my show that were adult birds, and it's very doable, but it's, I look for the ones that are eager and willing participants, just
and,
because...
And in fall, it's the same thing, exactly the same thing.
I certainly wouldn't put... even with my eager adults, I wouldn't put them on a new person that's never trained a bird before. I want those to have the easiest and best chance of success.
And that gets back to the origins, the beginning of this discussion, is for people that are listening, if they so choose, is to explore concepts of operant conditioning and become practically competent at it.
Sure.
So that they can, you know, shape those behaviors. And on their dogs, their parrots, their cats are great, just because they've got minds of their own. And if you can shape a cat, you're well on your way. Sometimes they're actually easier because it's hard to artificially modify their behavior. And
well, for one thing, with a cat, you know that they're doing it because you've taught them, not just because they're happy-go-lucky. Come on, let's go play.
And there's some great videos out there of examples of people shaping cats, but it's a guy with a friend of mine, Joel. Remember back when it was like when you couldn't drive a car and you were sitting in the passenger seat in the back seat watching your mom and dad drive a car? It looks easy. But once you get your hands on the steering wheel, oh, everything changes. And you're looking at somebody, watching somebody shape behavior and getting results and putting them on cue and chaining the behavior and making all those subtle evaluations. It all changes when you start thinking about it.
Sure.
And I literally, if I'm not in the right frame of mind, I don't pick my hawks up to work with them. I know that if the day... is I'm thinking about all kinds of things that are going wrong, right? You know, money, you know, family, all those kinds of that sort of thing. And it comes time to pick them up and train. I'll delay it until I can actually concentrate.
Well, I think this has been a fun conversation again, as usual. I'm going to wind it down here. I think we're just over an hour here in this discussion already. Yeah. Time flies when we're having fun.
Yeah.
We need to come back and do this again, of course, because we've barely touched some of these subjects, kind of got started on some of them.
And I've got other things to do, but I want to go out by your flight pen and see Wendy and Forrest and Skippy, who are at my house. They're out in a big flight cage with a bunch of the others. And as I drove in today, Wendy, Skippy, and Forrest came back right up to the wire.
They know you. They remember you.
Yep.
They're smart little birds.
They really are.
All right. Well, Steve, thanks for sitting here with us again.
Take care.
If you have questions or comments about something you heard during this podcast, please contact me through the Wings at Liberty website. That is www.wingsatliberty.com. Special thanks to Steve Lehman, Kathy Lehman, Benjamin Smith, and Susan Hilliard. I'm Chris Biro, and thanks for joining us.
This has been a podcast from wingsatliberty.com. This podcast was produced by Chris Biro, all rights reserved.